Hello and welcome to An Engineer's Journey Through the Book of Mormon. We explore the Book of Mormon with the assumption that science worked the same then as it does now and that the characters are real people with the same types of feelings and tendencies as you and me today. The views and opinions expressed here are strictly those of the narrator and should not be considered official interpretations in any way. And now An Engineer's Journey Through the Book of Mormon. Hello and welcome back. I'm going to do something a little bit different today. In covering Alma 43 through 46, I'm going to tell the story of Captain Moroni and the title of Liberty. 1 Nephi 19:23 says we can gain profit and learning by likening the scriptures to ourselves. I see this as an invitation to use our own personal experience to interpret the scriptures, and a license to add our own spin to what we read, provided it does not contradict the available information. I've done my best to play by these rules, using all available information and making connections where I see them. I'm simply going to tell my version of the story. We concluded our last episode with the Lamanite army preparing to invade the Nephites. Alma's mission to the Zoramites had failed. The Zoramites had joined the Lamanites, and the Zoramites were encouraging the Lamanites to attack. Knowing that an invasion was imminent, Ammon's converts had fled from the land of Jershon, and Captain Moroni had brought the Nephite army to Jershon to stop the Lamanite forces. And they were badly outnumbered, and Moroni was a young general, which leads to our trivia question from last time. What age was Captain Moroni when he took command of the Nephite army? The answer to that is in Alma 43:17, and Moroni took all the command in the government of their wars, and he was only 25 years old when he was appointed chief captain over the armies of the Nephites. He was only 25 years old when he was made general of the Nephite army. Was that unusually young? Well, we'll talk more about that in a future video. Now Alma 43. So to quickly recap the situation, Alma's missionary effort to the Zoramite apostate group had failed. The Zoramites had joined the Lamanite nation, and they drove all believers out of the city of Antionum. Ammon's people in Jershon welcomed these refugees, which made the Zoramites angry, and they persuaded the Lamanites to join them in attacking the Nephites. The Nephites knew that Ammon's people in Jershon had sworn an oath to never take up arms in battle, so to keep them from being slaughtered, they transplanted them from Jershon to Melek, and stationed the Nephite army at Jershon to stop the Lamanite attack. Moroni knew his army was badly outnumbered by the Lamanites, and he needed something to inspire his inexperienced army and give them a fighting chance. He instructed his men, his blacksmiths, and anyone willing to help to make armor. Although armor is now a common, even ubiquitous, aspect of warfare, it was not widespread in the Americas at this time. Moroni's army made helmets, breastplates, and arm shields, and they also gathered thick clothing to soften the blows of attackers. Their armor was a hodgepodge of parts and pieces and scrap metal, but it would do the job. But even more importantly, the armor gave Moroni's men confidence and an identity. Having armor meant that you were a soldier in Moroni's army, because only Moroni's soldiers had armor. The Lamanites were also preparing for battle. They had no armor. Zoramite soldiers were known for their violence and ferocity in battle, with the most brutally violent being their leaders. They were led by a warrior named Zerahemnah, who is renowned for his strength, fierceness, and cruelty, and, in my version, he was recognized for having a long braid of hair that hung nearly down to his waist. After much suspense and waiting, Nephite scouts told Moroni one morning that the Lamanite army was coming. Moroni's men scrambled to put on their makeshift armor and then waited for them to arrive. During the American Civil War, the Confederate soldiers were known for their battle cry, the Rebel Yell, as it was called. It was an awful and fearsome sound that struck terror into the opposing troops. It was a high-pitched, deafening, blood-curdling scream that lived on in the nightmares of Union soldiers long after the war had ended. A Lamanite battle cry would have been similar. an awful, deafening, high-pitched, panic-inducing, all-encompassing cacophony. And the Nephites had no answer for it. They could shout, "For Zarahemla!" But even though that might make him feel better, it did nothing to scare or intimidate the Lamanites. Moroni's men saw birds rising into the air and other signals that the Lamanite soldiers were approaching. They anxiously held their weapons and their captains tried to keep them in formation. Young Nephite men, nearly in tears, gripped their swords, patted their armor, and whispered quiet promises to God. And then as they watched, the Lamanite army began emerging from a distant grove of trees. Most of them were naked other than their loincloths. Only the Zoramite leaders were wearing clothes. The Lamanites began walking forward, shouting and shaking their weapons. They moved quickly, wanting to get near enough for their final sprinting charge. But as they approached, they saw sunlight reflecting back at them from the Nephite army. In addition to seeing the reflection of light on swords and spears, they also saw the reflection of homemade metal plates that they wore as armor. This was new and unknown to the Lamanites, and it made them stop. They really had no desire for a serious battle. They had been told that Ammon's people living in Jershon had taken an oath of peace and were unwilling to fight back. They had been hoping for a quick slaughter followed by pillaging and plunder. So when they realized that they would be fighting soldiers in armor rather than peaceful villagers, the Zoramite leaders held a quick conference. They decided to abandon the field and pick another target, somewhere unprotected, that they could attack without resistance. As the Lamanites retreated from the field, Moroni's men erupted in cheers. It was all the Nephite leaders could do to stop their men from chasing them. Feeling victorious, they laughed and shouted and they pounded each other's armor. But Moroni was not celebrating. The Lamanites had spared his army, but where had they gone? He sent his scouts to follow the Lamanite army and learn of their movements, and he sent his swiftest messenger to find the prophet Alma and ask who the next target would be. Alma was still in Jershon. He had not gone home from his mission yet, and he was located quickly. He told the messengers that the Lamanite army was traveling through the northern wilderness and planning to attack the unprotected land of Manti. They were marching fast, but because of their route, Moroni would have time to intercept them. So Moroni sent messengers to Manti, warning that a Lamanite invasion was coming, and people throughout that region began gathering and preparing for battle. Moroni left one of his captains and a small group of men to defend the city in Jershon and ordered the rest of his force to run as fast as possible toward the land of Manti. The land of Manti was on a large plain just south of a small range of mountains. A river called Sidon ran along the valley floor between the mountains through the land of Manti and then onward until it eventually reached the sea. Alma told Moroni that the Lamanites planned to come through the valley and attack Manti from the north. Moroni's army had already been outnumbered, and he made it even smaller by leaving some of his men to defend Jershon. But when he learned that the Lamanite army was coming through the valley, he had an idea. Remember, this was in the days of hand-to-hand combat. If you could force your enemy into a narrow space, their greater numbers would be much less of an advantage, and the defenders get to choose where a battle happens. A quick but related tangent. You've probably heard about the Battle of Thermopylae. This is the battle that the movie 300 is based on. It was a battle fought in Greece in 480 BC. An army of more than 100,000 Persians invaded Greece. The people were fleeing, and the Greek army needed to buy them some time. The Persian army needed to travel through a narrow pass, only about 50 feet wide, and an army of only 300 Spartans met them at this pass. Despite being outnumbered by more than 300-1, this group of 300 Spartans held back the army of more than 100,000 Persians for 3 days, buying enough time for the people to escape. And although Moroni had never heard of Leonidas and his tactics at Thermopylae, he used a similar strategy. To reach the land of Manti, the Lamanite army would need to travel along a path between a mountain and the river Sidon. A large hill named Ripla was at the north end of the valley on the east side of the river, and the Lamanites would pass it in the final miles before their attack. Moroni stationed a small group of men on the southeast side of this hill. This small group of men would be responsible for making the Lamanite army cross to the other side of the river, where the main Nephite army was waiting. Now, although this small group was few in number, they were an elite group of warriors led by a man named Lehi, who was easily the most dangerous soldier in Moroni's army. I've heard people talking about who would be the toughest fighter in the Book of Mormon. It's usually guys having this discussion. Some people say Ammon because of how he defended the king's flocks in Alma 17. Others say Teancum, who we'll meet in a future video, who was literally a straight-up assassin. But the correct answer to the who's the toughest fighter question would be Lehi. You might think I'm exaggerating, but let's jump ahead to Alma 49. 2 years later, when the Lamanite army was preparing to attack a city. Here's verse 16. And behold, Moroni had appointed Lehi to be chief captain over the men of that city, and it was that same Lehi who fought with the Lamanites in the valley on the east of the river Sidon. And now behold, it came to pass that when the Lamanites had found that Lehi commanded the city, they were again disappointed, for they feared Lehi exceedingly. Think about that. 2 years later, the Lamanites were still afraid of him. The whole army was afraid to attack a city because that soldier that they'd seen at the river Sidon was inside it and he might get out. Or we could jump ahead to Alma 52:6, where Lehi and his men basically shut down a Lamanite army. And Lehi pressed upon their rear with such fury with his strong men that the Lamanites in the rear delivered up their weapons of war, and the remainder of them, being much confused, knew not whether to go or to strike. So if you could choose anyone from the Book of Mormon to have your back in a bar fight, and ladies, I apologize, but I've actually heard guys having that discussion. But if you were to pick Ammon or Teancum to back you up in a bar fight, your opponent would thank you for not choosing Lehi. Moroni told Lehi to wait for the Lamanites to pass the hill Ripla and then surprise them from the east by attacking them through the gap between Ripla and the hill to the south of it. Moroni and the rest of the army were waiting across the river on the west side of the valley. Scouts on top of Ripla would signal the Lamanite position. Everyone got ready, and they didn't have to wait very long. A scout signaled that the Lamanite army had reached the valley and had turned southward. They were moving silently so that the people of Manti would not know that they were coming. Then the scout signaled that the Lamanites were directly west of Ripla, and then a final signal meant that they had reached the south end of the hill. And Lehi's force emerged from behind the hill and attacked the soldiers at the back of the army. The Lamanites were caught completely off guard and unprepared. The soldiers in the rear turned to fight. They had counted on having the advantage of numbers, but when the path is only wide enough for 5 or 10 people, and they have 5 or 10 soldiers who are better than yours, and they're wearing armor, and one of them is Lehi, it doesn't matter how big your army is, you run. The Lamanites began splashing across the river to the west side. Lehi's men didn't pursue them. Instead, they lined the river's east bank to prevent them from crossing back over. No sooner had the Lamanites crossed the river than Moroni, with another group of elite troops, attacked them from the north on the right, forcing them southward. And once again, the invaders were trapped on a narrow strip of land with only a few of their men able to engage the Nephites in battle. Leaving the hindmost to deal with Moroni's men, Zerahemnah and the bulk of the army ran south, hoping to outrun the soldiers who were wearing armor and then pillage and destroy the people of Manti, and also hoping for a larger battlefield where they could bring their full numbers to bear. But they had just started southward when they ran into the main Nephite Horus wearing armor and ready for battle. But Zerahemnah was no coward. If he could break through the Nephite line, there would be nothing between his men and Manti. He began screaming the Lamanite war cry. This caught on and spread, inspiring his men to levels of ferocity never before witnessed in the Americas. They crushed the Nephites' helmets or even split them in two. Spears pierced right through the Nephites' heavy breastplates. Swords sliced through their thick clothing, severing arms and limbs. Lamanite casualties were heavy, but they had numbers and momentum on their side. Moroni's army was fighting hard, but they were losing morale, and he couldn't do anything about it because he was fighting the other end of the snake at the north end of the battlefield. He knew his men couldn't last much longer against such aggression, and if they turned and ran, it would all be over. How could he inspire his men? How could he send a message from one end of the battlefield where he was at to the other where his men were trying to hold the line? Seeing they were about to flee, verse 48 says, he inspired their hearts with these thoughts. Yea, the thoughts of their lands, their liberty, yea, their freedom from bondage. And then it says, his men cried with one voice unto the Lord. But what does that mean, crying with one voice? It means they began a chant for God, religion, freedom, our peace, our wives, our children. Moroni and his men and Lehi and his men shouted this until it echoed off the valley walls. For God, religion, freedom, our peace, our wives, our children. Verse 49, and it came to pass that they turned upon the Lamanites, and they cried with one voice unto the Lord their God for their liberty and their freedom from bondage. The high-pitched screaming of the Lamanite battle cry began to yield to the pulsating thunder of the Nephite war chant. And as their battle yell faded, so did their courage. Lamanites began lowering their swords, and they began fleeing back toward the river. Verse 50, and they began to stand against the Lamanites with power, and in that selfsame hour that they cried unto the Lord for their freedom, the Lamanites began to flee before them, and they fled even to the waters of Sidon. When they reached the riverside, and they panicked because they couldn't cross over, Lehi and his men were waiting there, and so they were trapped. Now Moroni, when he saw their terror, commanded his men that they should stop shedding their blood. Moroni spoke loudly to as many Lamanites as could hear him. The Lamanites, he said, had come intending to conquer and enslave the Nephites through bloodshed. They hated the Nephites because of their God and religion, but this same God had made the Nephites victorious. But despite winning the battle, Nephites did not hate the Lamanites and had no desire to slay them. Any Lamanite willing to leave his weapons and swear to never again wage war against the Nephites was free to leave. Those unwilling to take an oath of peace could stay and finish the battle. Zerahemna, the Zoramite leader with that long braid, came forward and handed his bow, sword, and scimitar to Moroni. But he refused to kneel and would not take an oath. Paraphrasing, he said, I don't agree to your terms. Why take an oath that I know that my children and I will break? My men and I will depart peacefully, but we will be back. He spat at Moroni's feet, and he gave his braid a toss. It is your armor, not your God, that has made you victorious today. Take our weapons, let us go, otherwise we'll retain our swords and we will perish or conquer. Moroni tossed the weapons back at Zerahemna's feet and said, then we'll end the battle. I can't unsay what I've said. Depart with an oath of peace or you'll be destroyed. Zerahemna picked up his sword, but instead of returning to his men, he charged Moroni. And one of Moroni's bodyguards intercepted the charge and shattered Zerahemna's blade with a single stroke. He shoved Zerahemna's face down into the muddy riverbank, pulled back on his long braid, exposing his throat, and Moroni reminded him, we are not men of blood. So instead of killing Zerahemna, he used his sword to saw off his braid. Then he allowed Zerahemna, missing his signature braid, to retreat. As Zerahemna scrambled back to his men, the soldier skewered Zerahemna's hair with the point of his sword and held it in the air. Do you recognize this? He shouted. It has fallen to the earth, and unless you take an oath, so will you. Scores of frightened Lamanite warriors came forward, dropped their weapons at Moroni's feet, took an oath, crossed the river Sidon, walked past Lehi's group, and began their march back to the northern wilderness. But soon, normal Lamanites were willing to leave. Zerahemna screamed curses at Moroni and encouraged his men to attack. Moroni was angered by his stubbornness and gave a command, and the battle resumed. But the Nephites were energized, the Lamanites were demoralized, and Zerahemna quickly realized that the battle was lost, went and knelt before Moroni and surrendered his sword. Then he and his men took a covenant of peace and left northward through the valley back to the wilderness. With the battle over, Moroni and his men began the task of clearing the battlefield, casting bodies into the river, and allowing them to drift out to sea. The the river stained crimson. The Nephites mourned the loss of their fallen brethren, but they also rejoiced. Not only had they survived, but they had defeated an army that greatly outnumbered them. The people of Manti and also their own wives and children were safe from Lamanite attacks. Moroni, who was younger than most of his men, was admired and adored. Not only was he an exceptional warrior, but he was an inspired strategist and general. Still shocked and humbled at having won, the Nephite men returned home to cities, villages, and farms throughout the land, proudly displaying their armor and telling and retelling about their astonishing victory to anyone willing to listen. The prophet Alma returned home and then departed, never to be seen again. Alma's son Helaman was now the next high priest, and he and his brothers attempted to build the church. They went through the land ordaining teachers and priests, but after being given authority, the men they ordained began to teach their own doctrines and use their positions to gain wealth, and they no longer heeded the words of Alma or his brothers. In fact, many of them were so resentful of Helaman and the other church leaders that they plotted to kill them and seize leadership of the Nephites. Among those seeking to overthrow the church leaders was a large and charismatic man named Amalickiah. He secretly met with church leaders and judges, promising them positions of power if only he were made king of the land. Before long, these secret meetings were no longer secret, and people began to openly discuss whether it was time to abolish the government of judges and return a king to the throne. Because this idea was supported by both political and church leaders, it began to gain public support. When Moroni learned that his people were talking about making Amalickiah king, he had trouble believing it. What had happened to his people? Less than a year earlier, God had miraculously preserved them in a battle costing thousands of lives, and now they wanted to willingly vote themselves into servitude to a king? He couldn't believe it, but thanks to intimidation and misinformation, support for Amalickiah grew. People said that a king would be best and that Amalickiah was the right man for the job. When Moroni saw that Amalickiah was likely to carry the vote, he decided to take action. If the people wouldn't listen to the words of their high priests, maybe his soldiers would once again listen to their captain. He tore his coat and made a banner. Upon it, he wrote the battle cry that had inspired his men to victory, in remembrance of our God, religion, freedom, our peace, our wives, and our children. But I wonder if, instead of in remembrance of, a better translation might be remember. He fastened his banner to the end of a long pole, and then he put on his armor, and he bowed himself to the earth, and he prayed mightily unto his God for the blessings of liberty to rest upon his brethren, so long as there should a band of Christians remain to possess the land. And then, wearing his armor, he walked toward the city center, holding his banner up high. Word spread like wildfire. Captain Moroni had put on his battle armor, and he was carrying a banner with their battle cry. Men who had fought alongside him at Sidon left their plows and workbenches. Alma 46:21 says they put on their own armor and ran to join Moroni. The women and children had never seen this kind of energy, excitement, and determination from their brothers and fathers as when Moroni, the legendary captain, called his men to gather once again. When they had all gathered and the cheering had subsided, he spoke to his men. He reminded them how the conquered Lamanites had cast their weapons at his feet and made a covenant. He gave a brief sermon condemning Amalickiah and reminded them of the price they and their fallen brethren had paid for freedom. Then, just as the Lamanites had thrown their swords at Moroni's feet, his men tore their garments and threw them at Moroni's feet. Just as the Lamanites had covenanted to depart and fight no more, his men made a covenant to keep the commandments, to defend the name of Christ and or be torn asunder like their piled garments if they ever departed from righteousness. Moroni caused this banner to be sent from city to city, and hundreds and thousands of battle-scarred men saw it and remembered and gathered. All throughout the land, Amalickiah saw men gathering around Moroni's banner with the determination that he did not understand, but which he knew he could not overcome. He gathered his followers and fled south toward the land of Nephi, intending to join the Lamanite nation. But Moroni's army swiftly overtook them. Amalickiah and a few key followers managed to slip away and escape, but the rest of his men were detained. Moroni, as general, had been deputized by the chief judge to act as judge and jury in matters of war. He offered the captive Nephites a choice, similar to the one he had offered the Lamanites: take an oath supporting the Nephite government or be put to death. Hardly anyone refused the oath. Moroni's banner, with the battle cry, or the title of liberty as it came to be called, flew from every tower throughout the land, and they had peace for a time. Meanwhile, Amalickiah had been accepted by the Lamanites and was plotting to gain the Lamanite throne. But that's a story for another day. And now it's time for our trivia question. A few years later, the Lamanites again attacked the Nephites. Which city did they attack, and why did they choose it? Which Nephite city did the Lamanites attack, and why did they choose it? And we will see you next time.